The changes that have taken place in social communications during recent years and decades are obvious to all who have ears to hear and eyes to see. Communications experts in academia are constantly and continuously studying all the phenomena associated with these great changes, and are probably therefore the ones best placed to discuss the broader picture in abstract generality. I live these changes personally and in the concrete. I am immersed in the use of various communications media, and so also in their transformations. I got my start in communication as a writer for La Civiltà Cattolica, a cultural review that continues to publish lengthy and thoughtful analysis pieces today, just as it did when it was founded 160 years ago. Then I was sent to the radio and then to a television production center. My experience with these tools introduced me to and forced me to come to grips with the rapid development of communications technology, not only in order to communicate the relevance of the Christian message to current events. I also had to grasp the ways in which these new technologies were affecting life in the newsroom and behind the editor's desk. The advent of satellite distribution systems, especially at the radio, gave us the chance to bring Vatican Radio's linguistically diverse programming to vastly larger audiences all throughout the world. The coming of digital production profoundly changed the work methods and the professional profiles of both journalists and technicians. Then came the internet, and with it, new ways of gathering and exchanging information, instantaneous communication via email, and widespread channeled content distribution on the web. These past few years at the press office have shown me the need to look for ways to establish a more organic and constructive dialogue and exchange between the communications organs of the Holy See and today's world of social communications. For today's world is rapidly becoming something vastly different from what it was when my generation first experienced it. Back in April, a document prepared by Microsoft entitled Europe Logs On, European Internet Trends of Today and Tomorrow, offered the following piece of news. If things continue to grow at the projected rate, then by June of 2010, internet use will surpass traditional television use among European consumers, reaching an average of more than 14 hours per week to televisions 11 and 12. In 2008, internet surpassed all other media except television as the principal source of information regarding national and international current events. The march continues and seems unstoppable. Just so we understand each other, I consider myself interested in and responsible for many different vectors of communication in the Church, for communication to many different countries where a wide array of situations are to be encountered and where a broad spectrum of different circumstances obtain. I am well aware that in many very large parts of the world, communication happens in ways that are very different from those found in more developed countries. It is also true that even in the more developed countries, there are differences that need to be taken into account. The document I just cited speaks of a digital divide separating North and South also in Europe, as far as internet access and use is concerned. From the Church's point of view, leaving those with fewer possibilities on the margins is simply not an option. For us, The poor and developing countries are at least as important as the wealthy, if not more. So we cannot leave the traditional technologies and forms of communication by the wayside, for they are still necessary to serve a large part of humanity. At the same time, we cannot but be attentive to the direction in which communications are moving, nor can we allow ourselves to fall out of touch with the latest advancement in the world of communication. Reflection and debate regarding the way the Church communicates, both internally and externally, that is, with her members and with the larger world, have intensified recently, not only because of the discussion about the Pope and the Church, but also because of the way those discussions were conducted. The coverage was widespread, and just about every news outlet took an editorial stance on the point, on one point or another. Throughout it all, many different issues got confused, but no one can doubt that the whole business did raise some very real questions. It is our job to get to the bottom of those questions and then figure out something useful to say about them. A first and obvious consideration regards the speed and the intensity with which news spreads, especially sensational news. Internet communications have greatly increased both the speed with which the shock waves spread and their reach. Communication happens round the clock, 24 hours, 7 days. News no longer reaches people to the rhythm of the morning paper or the TV bulletins. More to this, the vast and ever-growing variety of voices makes it more and more difficult to attract people's attention, and this results in the tendency to sensationalize the news to spice up the headlines. Many journalists and many news outfits are endlessly searching for the next big scoop, as though getting it were the one thing that, in the midst of the great sea of words and images, can give their existence some sort of affirmation. We are all aware of this situation, and we see the continuous risks, but we cannot seem to understand how to fix it. Let's consider more closely some recent cases, like Pope Benedict's Regensburg Discourse, the Bishop Williamson affair, or the controversy of a Pope Benedict's statements regarding condoms and the spread of AIDS in Africa. Sensational reaction to each event came quickly, ranged broadly, and penetrated deeply. Answers to those critics were not lacking. They came not only from me, through the press office of the Holy See, but also from voices well disposed to the Church. These responses, however, were neither as numerous nor as media-friendly as the voices of the critics that occasioned them. And though they were not overly slow in coming, they were nevertheless, in a certain sense, rather late with respect to the surprise effect of the original shock wave. Once the first wave of criticism had passed, though, people were able to do some real hard thinking, and they did. The subsequent reflections were serious, penetrating, and well argued. It took a while for word of them to make its way through the communications channel and reach the public. But eventually, the public did hear about and really benefit from these contributions to the discussion. I am convinced that the question of Christian-Muslim relations has been addressed more frankly, more seriously, and with greater depth after Regensburg than before. That the clamorous response to the declaration of Bishop Williamson not only allowed us to make the true positions of the Pope and the Church regarding the Holocaust to be more widely known and clearly understood, but also serve to strengthen Catholic-Jewish relations and dialogue. That there is hope that re-establishment of the conversation with the followers of Archbishop Lefebvre might lead to a deeper and more balanced reading of Vatican II in the direction of a hermeneutic of renewal in continuity with the Church tradition, and that the debate of over condom is leading to greater understanding and awareness of what a truly effective AIDS prevention strategy is in Africa and elsewhere. I would like at this point to make something clear. I am not saying that everything we have done and are doing vis-à-vis Vatican communication is perfect. I do think, however, that in a world such as ours, we would be deluding ourselves if we thought that communication can always be carefully controlled or that it can always be conducted smoothly and as a matter of course. Is there any great institutional personality that, finding itself constantly in the limelight, is not the object of frequent criticism? We have dozens of ready examples in presidents and prime ministers. Why ought we think that the Pope or the Church in a secular world such as ours ought to be accepted? Whenever we face sensitive topics, we must inevitably proceed dialectically, from the statement of the position to criticism to a clear and more penetrating response. It is a mistake to think that we ought to avoid debate. We must always seek to conduct the debate in a way that leads to a better understanding of the Church position, and we must never get discouraged. We might add that the way such debates unfold is new as well. Debate is no longer generally driven by the contribution of a few well-known, trusted, and easily recognizable voices, for example, the op-ed writers of the major newspapers. The chorus of voices that take part in debate over issues today is much larger and more diverse. The membership of the chorus transcends the traditional limits of language and culture. It is indeed international and even global. In approaching the conclusion of the first part of my considerations, I must admit that it appears to me difficult to evaluate the meaning and the results of these debates in the long term. Presently, I cannot clearly say if the impact of the waves of criticism will have in the end negative and irreparable effects, or if the subsequent positive reaction after a deeper analysis can give long-term positive results. Probably it depends on case to case. So we need to look farther afield, and we also need to broaden our outlook. Today we approach the problem from the specific point of view of the Church, or of the Pope's image, or of the Christian truths we desire to proclaim. The problem, however, is not ours alone. It were ridiculous to think so. It is a general problem involving the family and the institutions of the state and the civil society. The problem regards the ability to have and to maintain sound points of reference in the flow of communication in the world. In seeking a right road for the Church to communicate, we are also looking for those roads which might be interesting and useful for everyone.